Good morning, brothers and sisters in Christ Jesus. Nahum's prophecy is one that is very important, though it occupies few pages of the Scriptures. It contains a prophecy of the destruction of Assyria's power and focuses on its capital city, Nineveh. The book ultimately symbolizes the restoration of the peace of Israel after the Catholic power is destroyed by Christ and the saints. It teaches us to wait in faith and patience while Yahweh works out His plan with this earth. Nahum means comforter. He was sent to send comfort to the nation of Israel, but was also sent to comfort us. His prophecy and fulfillment of it declares a surety of Yahweh's plan. The date of Nahum's writing is vague, and it seems the most viable source that we have of when it was written is from Josephus. He indicates Nahum's writing was during the latter part of the reign of Jotham, who reigned in 751 to 736 B.C., and the fulfillment was around 612 B.C. during the reign of Josiah, who reigned from 641 to 609 B.C. This would leave us with about 120 years from the writing of this prophecy to its fulfillment, with its ultimate fulfillment anticipated when Christ returns. What is the history of Nineveh to this point? Brother Gary has assisted us in showing the magnitude of the city and how large it was. But there are still a few points that would help us in our address this morning. We see in Genesis chapter 10, verses 8 through 11, that Cush begat Nimrod and began to be mighty and one in the earth, and a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. In the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. And out of that land forth he went into Asshur, or Assyria, and built Nineveh and the city of Rehoboth and Calah. The constructor of the city was Nimrod, and he went into Assyria and built it on the banks of the Tigris. Nineveh was the capital of the Assyrian Empire. Nineveh was a city that was widespread with idol worship from its very origin. Archaeologists have found many idols and altars of false gods in Nineveh. Sin, Ashur, Nergal, Shamash, Ninurta, Ishtar, Nabea of Borsippa are among the idols of worship that have been found there. Since the time of its initial construction, the city seems to have fallen and rebuilt possibly more than once, mostly due to its location. Unknown to Nimrod, he built it on a fault line which made it fall victim of earthquakes. The Syrians' dedication to the city enabled it to be rebuilt. When it was rebuilt, idol worship continued. That is, until it was divinely destroyed in 612 B.C. by Babylon and the Medes, not to be rebuilt again. 50 to 100 years before Nahum's prophecy, Yahweh was able to get the city to turn away from its evil ways through his prophet Jonah. This was quite an amazing feat, but did not last long. Nineveh was soon to return again to worshiping their many idols. The wealth of Nineveh was very great. It is estimated that the power and wealth of Nineveh continued to grow after the prophecy of Nahum was delivered, until it was fulfilled with the overthrow of Nineveh many years later. For Nahum says, speaking of its gold and silver, there is no end of the store. These riches, however, were not obtained alone by honest industry and gain, but by the conquest and spoil of other nations. The lion being the symbol of the Ninevite power, he styles the king of Assyria the old lion. The males of his family, the young lions, and the females of his harem, his lionesses, and their heir apparent, the lion's whelp. In speaking of the way the riches were heaped up in his vaults, the prophet says, the lions did tear in pieces enough for his whelps, and strangled for his lionesses, and filled his holes with prey, and his dens with raven. Due to all of this success, arrogance had filled the heart of Nineveh's leaders. When the righteous king Hezekiah was moving the people to resist the Assyrian king Sennacherib and his false god, Assyria did not hesitate to blaspheme against Yahweh. For we have this demonstration in the words of Rabshakeh. For he says, "Let not thy God whom thou trustest, O Hezekiah, deceive thee." Rabshakeh also blasphemes Yahweh to the people of the city of Jerusalem when he says, "Am I now come up without Yahweh against this place to destroy it? Yahweh said to me, go up against this land and destroy it." These examples attest to the fact that the moral condition of the city at the time of its greatest glory was excessively corrupt. Rome in the time of its glory is a meet example in its own right of the impiety and abomination rampant in Nineveh, whose fate, like that of her sister, Babylon, have become the type of that entire and complete desolation that awaits Rome and the government which supports her iniquity. Nahum bestows upon the city of Nimrod descriptions and symbols such as the well-favored harlot, the mistress of witchcrafts. In her day, she traded in nations and families whom she sold by lies and robbery, as Rome has done and continues to do at this present time. "Woe to the city of blood," saith Nahum. "It is all full of lies and robbery, and the prey departeth not." That is, it is not restored. For this cause he threatens her with ruin. Destruction was to overtake her because, says he, of the multitude of whoredoms of the well-favored harlot, the mistress of witchcrafts, that selleth nations through her whoredoms and families through her witchcrafts, upon all of whom her wickedness passed continually. The spiritual merchandise of the well-favored harlot was forced upon all nations by her military power. By her riches, she sent out large armies to compel the nations to receive her yoke and to purchase at the price of their religious liberty, civil independence, and precious metals the lies she had prepared by the incantations of her astrologers, magicians, and soothsayers, who, when her shame was displayed before the nations of the kingdoms she had spoiled, they emigrated to Babylon and became the wise men and counselors, the clergy and ministers of Nebuchadnezzar, the heir of her departed glory. Assyria was the great oppressing power at this time, with Israel being one of its victims, which is why it represented as having the yoke on Israel. Nineveh was the capital of the nation, and once it was defeated, it would represent the destruction of the Assyrian power and therefore the destruction of the yoke. In Nahum 1:13, we read, "For now I will break his yoke from off thee, and will burst thy bonds asunder." While several events transpired in bringing about the end of the glory of Nineveh, it can be summed up in the culminated in the following events. Nabopolassar, king of Babylon, having become old and infirm, associated his son Nebuchadnezzar, called the Second, and with him the throne of the kingdom. This young king is a celebrated Nebuchadnezzar spoken of in the book of Daniel. His exaltation to the joint occupation of the throne of Babylon with Nabopolassar occurred in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, king of the Jews. And 2 years before his father's decease, having mediated a peace between Ahasuerus, the king of Lydia, Nebuchadnezzar for himself and father contracted an alliance with Ahasuerus, king of the Medes, for the conquest and destruction of Nineveh. Having therefore united their forces, they besieged the city and took it, killed Sarachus, the king, and utterly destroyed it. The two armies enriched themselves with the spoils, and Ahasuerus, prosecuting his victories, made himself master of all the cities of the kingdoms. Ahasuerus, the king of Lydia, and Nebuchadnezzar for himself, and father contracted an alliance with Ahasuerus, king of the Medes, for the conquest and destruction of Nineveh. Having therefore united their forces, they besieged the city, took it, and killed Sarachus the king, and utterly destroyed it. The two armies enriched themselves with the spoils, and Ahasuerus, prosecuting his victories, made himself master of all the cities of the kingdom of Assyria, except Babylon and Chaldea, which belonged to Nabopolassar. Thus, Babylon and Chaldea became the nucleus of the new Assyrian empire. The wings of the great eagle were plucked from the Assyrian line and is made to stand upon its feet, and a man's heart was given unto it. Nebuchadnezzar commenced his career as a general of the kingdom and by the conquest of Syria and Judea, he succeeded to the sole inheritance of a throne, which at his father's death comprehended, under his dominion, Chaldea, Assyria, Arabia, Syria, Palestine, over which he reigned in Babylon, the capital of the empire, for 43 years. The destruction of Nineveh by the kings of Babylon and Media fulfilled the prophecies of Nahum and Zephaniah. The latter, who prophesied in the reign of Josiah, king of the Jews, said, Yahweh will stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria, and will make Nineveh a desolation and a dry like a wilderness. And flocks shall lie down in the midst of her, and all the beasts of the nations, both cormorant and the bittern, shall lodge in the upper lintels of it. Their voice shall sing in the windows, desolation shall be in the thresholds, for he shall uncover the cedar work. This is the rejoicing city that dwelt carelessly, that said in her heart, I am supreme, and none beside me. How has she become a desolation, a place for beasts to lie down, and everyone that passes by her shall hiss and wag his head. Such is Nineveh. Such has she been for ages. Today, the location of the city has been unearthed due to the efforts of archaeologists of the last couple centuries. The whole city lies in ruin. One end has been excavated, and the other has a Muslim mosque upon it and leaves no way for it to be excavated. Nineveh and Babylon, the destroyers of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah, have both fallen and vanished. Israel, Judah, and Jerusalem, and the people of the city of Yahweh remain and are preparing to blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit. Nahum begins his prophecy of comfort to the righteous with warnings unto the wicked who deny Yahweh is the one true God who is worthy to be obeyed and reverenced. He says, Elkanah, an avenging Yahweh, Yahweh avengeth and is very furious. Yahweh recompenseth his adversaries, and he reserveth his wrath for his enemies. Yahweh is slow to anger, though great in power. This is an instance of rare use with this title of deity, Elkanah. Cana has been translated in the King James Version as jealous. We are told in Exodus 34, verse 14, For thou shalt worship no other El, for Yahweh, whose name is Cana, is Cana El. In these verses, we find that while God is patient, service to false gods will not be tolerated. Yahweh is a jealous of the honor of his name. Therefore, he avengeth it in fury upon Sennacherib, Nebuchadnezzar, and their city. Of Nebuchadnezzar, Nahum says to Nineveh, From thee hath there gone forth one who imagined evil against Yahweh, a most wicked counselor. But though his pretended God was obeyed by many, thus saith Yahweh, Though they are victorious and so many, yet shall they be cut down and pass away. Then addressing Israel, he says, Though I afflicted thee, I will afflict thee no more. For now I will break his yoke from off thee, and I will burst thy bonds in sunder, and Yahweh will command concerning thee, that thy name be no more scattered abroad. Then in Nineveh, he says, From the house of thy gods will I cut off the graven and molten image. I will appoint thy grave, for thou art vile. But Judah shall live in peaceful independence when her oppressors are no more. Nahum saw this in his vision as the consummation of the controversy of Zion, mentioned in Isaiah 34, verse 8. For it is the day of Yahweh's vengeance, the year of recompenses for the controversy of Zion. Nineveh and all her successors in her great contest for Yahweh's possession of his people and land should be destroyed. For the decree is that the wicked shall be wholly consumed and cut off. Therefore, saith the prophet Nahum, Behold upon the mountains the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, who publisheth peace. Keep, O Judah, thy feast, perform thy vows, for he shall no more pass through thee. The wicked is wholly consumed, he is cut off. The power of the wicked shall no more pass through Judea, because of him who brings the proclamation of peace to Judea. But the power of the wicked is supreme. The power of the wicked is supreme there to this day. Therefore, in these words, Nahum looked beyond the fall of Nineveh He saw in the future, indicated by Isaiah, in similar words, saying, "How beautiful appear on the mountains the feet of him that bringeth good things, of him that proclaimeth peace, of him that bringeth good tidings of good, of that proclaimeth salvation, that saith to Zion, Elohim reigneth, the watchmen shall lift up their voice, and with their voice together shall they sing. For with their own eyes shall they see that Yahweh restoreth Zion. Burst forth into joy, sing together, ye waste places of Jerusalem. For Yahweh hath comforted his people, he hath redeemed Israel. Yahweh hath made bare his holy arm in the sight of all the nations, and all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our Elohim."
It is now open for your comments or questions. Brother Philip.
I'd like to offer my thanks to Brother Ricky for giving quite a comprehensive summary of these three chapters and beautifully bringing it to a conclusion with that 15th verse of chapter 1. The comment I'd like to make by way of discussion is based on verses 13 to 15 of chapter 3, particularly where it makes the comment, "Behold, thy people in the midst of thee are women, the gates of the land shall be set wide open unto thine enemies, the fire shall devour thy bars." And in verse 15, "There shall the fire devour thee." Brother Ricky gave us a description of the destruction of this great city, and I think Brother Gary and Brother Ricky has given us an indication of the extent of that city. And Brother Ricky also made reference to the archaeological discoveries in and around Nineveh. Now, some years ago, I read a book. It was an old book, and it wasn't a Christadelphian publication, but it was a book on archaeology, and particularly on the British Museum. The author of the book was describing some of the exhibits which had recently come into the British Museum from Nineveh. And the colouring of the brick was somewhat reddish, because you can actually see these in the British Museum today. The colour of the brick was somewhat reddish in its nature, if I remember correctly. It's been a couple of years since I've been there. But there was also a blackness covering the brick as well. And one of the attendants at the British Museum was busily there with a particular kind of water with a detergent in it, which wasn't going to damage the exhibit, but they were trying busily to get the blackness out of the brick. And the author records in the book that she had said to the individual, "Look, you're wasting your time. God's word said that Nineveh was going to be burned with fire, that her bricks were actually going to be impregnated with the evidence of her destruction." And even today, if you go there, you can still see those bricks in the British Museum. They've got various friezes there with the reddish kind of brick, but you can detect the blackness that would have been caused as a result of the terrific fire, amongst other judgments, that devoured Nineveh. And she basically pinpointed, and I was really impressed with that at the time, where she actually said, "You know, here is the evidence of the Bible. Here is the testimony of the living God burnt into the very bricks which once formed part of the proud city of Nineveh." It was there as a living testimony. I guess that's a bit of a contradiction. It was there as a testimony to the living word of God that what God had said was going to happen actually came to pass. And we are privileged today to actually see the evidence of what had happened, and greatly encouraged in our faith. Because these things in this age of skepticism and atheism and general unbelief, these things are things which can help us and help our young people in the midst of this evil and wicked generation in which we live, can help us strengthen our faith that we can actually see the evidence of God's word.
Brother Jim.
Brother Chairman and brethren and sisters, it's not my comment, but Brother Philip was talking about British Museum. I remember the first time I went there and stood looking at the gates of Nineveh. It was really impressive to think that I was standing there and seeing those gates that you read so much of in the Bible, and there they are right in front of me. But, it's worth the trip to the museum if you're in that area. Concerning Nahum, we're told, behold the goodness and the severity of God. Yesterday we saw Jonah. We saw the goodness of God. The people repented, and God did not destroy them. Today we see in the book of Nahum the same people, but with an entirely different outcome. The name Nahum is comforter, but we don't find comfort in this book for Nineveh. He starts off, God is jealous, and the Lord avenges. The Lord avenges and is furious. The Lord will take vengeance on his adversary, and he reserves wrath for his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power, and will not at all acquit the wicked. Who can stand before his indignation, and who can endure the fierceness of his anger? God indeed is a jealous God, as Brother Ricky pointed out. Jealousy, wrath, vengeance are all expressions of his absolute holiness, his absolute justice, and his intolerance of sin. If God were to look on sin lightly, he would not be a good God. God does not look at sin lightly. And we see in the two books concerning the prophecies of Nineveh, the goodness and the severity of God. And so many times, and rightly so, we focus on Christ and the goodness of God. And like you say, amen, so be it. It needs to be focused on, because if it were not for that, none of us would have any hope. But Nahum here is focusing on the fact that when they repented, they turned back to their idols. And now we see the severity of God, the vengeance that he will wrought on those who do not follow his word.
Brother Ben?
Yeah, just to add to what Brother Jim said there, he quoted from verse 3 of chapter 1, which says, Yahweh is slow to anger, great in power, and will not at all acquit the wicked. And if we look at the Hebrew there, if we look at Strong's, that phrase, will not at all acquit the wicked, those are the same words that are used back in Exodus chapter 34, where Yahweh, you know, proclaims his name and says, Yahweh, El, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, and that will by no means clear the guilty. So just as, you know, Brother Jim was saying, you know, we read at the end of Jonah in that last, very last verse where Yahweh basically tells Jonah, he says, you know, should I not spare Nineveh, or as the revised version says, should I not have pity on Nineveh? And so we see here, that's the, you know, the first part of that Exodus account. You know, Yahweh is merciful and gracious, but as it's directly quoted in this third verse, he will by no means clear the guilty.
Brother Curtis?
I had a note there over on chapter 3, verses 8 through 10. Talks about no. The short section, verses 8 through 10, cites the case of the populous No, that is a great Egyptian city of Thebes called No Amon, because of the god Amon, worshipped there. Thebes had been the capital of Upper Egypt and famous for from antiquity for its splendor and military power. Its pharaohs, conquerors for six centuries, 1700 to 1100 B.C. approximately, had made it center of a world empire, like a former Nineveh, in fact. Its palaces and temples were immense, as the ruins of Karnak and Luxor bear witness to this day. Its great temples, halls, colonnades, colossal statues, obelisks, sculptures were on a scale of imposing magnificence, of which there is probably no parallel in the world. The Great Hall of Karnak was 170 feet wide by 329 feet long, with 134 columns of colossal proportion supporting the roof, some of them 62 feet high and 32 feet in circumference. The pharaohs were gods. Their palaces were therefore temples in which the statues of the monarchs were 10 times the size of the rest of the soldiers. Thebes were situated upon the Nile stream among the rivers, and the word is the plural of the usual word of the Nile. The sea was the Nile itself, which formed one of the city's defenses. In her strength, she received the homage of Cush, Ethiopia, the people of the South Egypt, as well as Put and Laban, the inhabitants of North Africa. Yet, as Isaiah has prophesied, this great city had quite recently been brought to dust. Therefore, two Assyrian invasions of Egypt, when Ashurbanipal in 663 BC had completed its sack. How should Nineveh think herself worthy to escape a similar fate? So that was the example they were getting them, was the Nahum was given Assyria, was the what happened to the great city of No. Which we don't read that much in the Bible, but we do read a little bit about the city of No. And today you can see, all the stuff that's left over if you ever get to visit Egypt. Also reading there toward the end of the chapter there, in chapter 3, it talks about the fire devoured the bars. The fire shall devour the bars, there in verse 13. And reading it, sounds like the ruler there set the city on fire so that they would keep the invaders from getting them. So I don't know if that's the case or not, but that's what one suggestion is, that the ruler set the city on fire so that the Babylonians couldn't get to him.
Brother Gordon.
Yeah, I'd just like to thank Brother Ricky for a job well done. It's a lot of information there. I got a question on verse 4 of the second chapter, and I'm just going by memory here, but I'm pretty sure I've heard that applied to the modern day automobile. Now, whether that was just a suggestion or, I don't remember that part, but I just wondered if there were some comments on that.
Brother Philip.
Just making a few comments while the other brethren are gathering their thoughts. With regards to Brother Gordon's question there about verse 4, I must admit I hadn't heard that suggestion. Personally, I've looked at chapter 2 as a graphic description of the armies that were coming against Nineveh, and that the chariots would have been observed as they were approaching. The chariots shall rage in the streets, they shall jostle one against another in the broad ways, they shall seem like torches, they shall run like lightnings. We know that with the chariot being pulled by the horses, must have looked a really fearful sight in their charge towards the city. And as Brother Ricky's brought out, this was a joint operation by the Babylonians and the Medes, so there must have been a tremendous army that was coming against Nineveh. And I think that the details here are indicative, perhaps, of the power that was lined up against this, what might have seemed an impregnable city being so great. So maybe some of the other brethren will have some comments on that, but I've always seen that this second chapter is really a graphic description of how Nineveh came to her doom. For example, then, when we look at verse 8, but Nineveh is of old like a pool of water, yet they shall flee away. Stand, stand, shall they cry, but none shall look back. And we can imagine maybe the generals of the armies trying to encourage their men to stand firm against the onslaught of the Babylonians and the Medes. And they would be crying to their troops, stand, stand. But it said, but none shall look back. Or I think the margin renders it, none shall cause them to turn. Basically, the troops could not keep formation, and they would disintegrate in the very face of the enemy. So I think the description, actually I think I read once the Jerusalem Bible, though I wouldn't be a fan of a Jerusalem Bible particularly, but the reading through it give you a kind of a racy account of how this city fell. And I think, if I may, just make a quick comment on Brother Jim Somerville's remarks. He said about Nahum's name meaning comforter. And I think his point was really interesting, really, because I think we all look on the world scene and we see what I've always regarded as Assyria as being typical of the latter-day Assyrian, namely Russia and the great host that she's amassing. And when you look at Isaiah chapter 10, you see the great pride of this modern empire, which was characterized by Assyria of old, building up the image and laden herself with thick clay. And we've started to see this now in the Crimea, and we can see that this is going to be the way forward, that Putin is going to build up this empire. And yet you remember Zechariah chapter 14, and you see the picture as well of the destruction of Israel. And it's, you know, we're lovers of Israel, we're lovers of God's people, and it very nigh breaks your heart to think of the great destruction that Russia is going to inflict upon the people of Israel. And especially with all her great victories, and you think, it's almost hard to bear the thought of Israel being crushed, until you start to realize that, you know, Israel are there in unbelief of the Messiah. To a large extent, they're atheistic. A lot of them are godless. But then, as Brother Jim has pointed out, the comfort. It will be comfort to Israel in the day of her calamity when the latter-day Assyrian will fall on the mountains of Israel. And I think it's comfort to us as we behold upon the mountains the feet of him that bringeth good tidings. Because those feet are the feet of the rainbowed angel that we earnestly hope to be part of, and we will be, in the mercy of God, part of the judgments that will come down upon the latter-day Assyrian.
Brother, right there.
Yeah, I also have a question. I'm wondering, what about the division between Nineveh and Babylon? Weren't they both tied into Assyria? And why did they get separated and go against each other?
Brother Jim?
I think when we think of the Assyrian Empire, we think of Iraq. And yet, depending on where we are in history, Nineveh was the capital of ancient Assyria. The Chaldeans had their center in Babylon, just south of that. And as the Chaldean Empire arose in power, as Brother Rick pointed out, the Chaldeans joined forces with the Medes, but attacked Assyria. And when Nebuchadnezzar took over that area, he assumed the title of the Assyrian Empire. And so it's almost like the fall of Rome. The Roman Empire continued with different heads after Rome fell, but it's still, we think of it as the Roman Empire, but it was a completely different empire, a different dynasty, if you would. And it's the same thing with the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrian Empire was Nineveh. The Chaldeans were down south in Babylon, but when the Chaldeans and the Medes overthrew Assyria, Assyrians moved up to Haran, and then finally to Carchemish, and that's when when Pharaoh Necho came out against Josiah, he was going to defend the Assyrian Empire against the Babylonians and the Medes, but he did not succeed, and the Assyrian Empire fell, and the Chaldean Empire took over. But in history, we kind of call the Chaldean Empire the Assyrian Empire, and so does Daniel with the concept of the wings being plucked from the lion and the lion standing up on its feet. He treats it like it was the same lion, the same empire, but with a different phase. Just one other thing, those verses, I think Brother Phil mentioning about the enemies coming against Nineveh there in that second chapter, and it talks about the gates being opened and the defenses crumbling. According to history written by the Assyrians, by the Chaldeans, when they attacked the city, they said there was a flood, and it was situated on the Tigris River. And according to their writings, there was a flash flood that opened up part of the wall, including the parts that held the gates, and allowed them access into the city. And I wouldn't doubt it, because Nineveh was fortified. Nineveh wasn't going to go down easy. But all it takes is a little extra rain, and all of a sudden those great defenses that man had for centuries built up and trusted in was gone. And, you know, I mean, like I say, that's according to their account.
I'd like to thank Brother Ricky for his comments on this. In the first chapter that was read, in the second verse, we think about words that describe God. Is it jealousy, revenge, fury, vengeance? Are those the words that pop into our mind? You know, we think of jealousy as something that is a bad thing. If somebody's jealous over something without cause, then it's, you know, they can be almost to the point of crazy. But in the beginning of the third verse, the Lord is slow to anger. He gives Israel and us enough time, and his jealousy is justified because, as we know, there's many types, many times in the Bible, Israel and Judah is referred to as a harlot and a whore. You know, they were not truthful to God throughout their history. And, you know, it just brings the other aspect of God. We have to make sure that we stay on that true path. There will be enough time for us to either continue and stay on that straight and narrow path or to stray from that path.
Brother Bill.
Yeah, I guess when Brother Philip was talking about the destruction of the latter-day Assyrian, specifically in chapter 2, when we read of verse 3, the shield of his mighty men is made red, the valiant men are in scarlet, my center column has scarlet as flaming or fiery, which gives us an image there. We talk of chariots with flaming torches. In the same verse, you go down in verse 4, they shall run like lightning. And as you read through these things, it brought to my mind the cherubim of Ezekiel that we read in Ezekiel chapter 1 of the four living creatures, where these four living creatures, verse 12 tells us that they had a purpose. Their purpose was they went everyone straight forward. They were like burning coals of fire, similar to the torches we're reading about, and it tells us in verse 13 that these living creatures, the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning, and the living creatures ran and returned as the appearance of a flash of lightning. Similar to the language we're reading here in Nahum chapter 2 of the destruction of the Assyrian power in the latter day Assyrian destruction, the cherubim, their mission going straight forward, not turning to the left or to the right, will be the mission of the destruction of the latter day Assyrian.
Brother Jim?
A little bit more history to go with what Brother Jim Somerville was talking about. The Tigris River fed the moat that went around Nineveh, so it was quite impressive. And they thought they had thought of everything. They had an overflow gate that they could open if the Tigris River flooded, which was a brilliant idea. So they opened their overflow gate, and it wasn't enough. So evidently they had not had a flood in the realm of what transpired. So the overflow gate is what gave way, and when that gave way, their precious wall was gone. So when the king in the palace heard that the wall had been breached, he knew that the party was over, literally. And it's thought that, and proven by archaeologists, he built a great funeral pyre in the palace itself and killed himself, his eunuchs, his concubines, piled all his treasures in a big pile and lit it up before the enemy could make an entrance. So the bricks that they're talking about and everything that was burnt was started by the king himself.
Brother Philip.
Just a few thoughts leading on from the question of Brother Chuck and the explanation of Brother Jim. As Brother Jim pointed out, there was obviously we see it today, don't we? You know, political rivalries between powers, even though they're living on the same landmass. You'd think perhaps that they could somehow get on together, and yet, you know, the flesh, you know, tries to grasp power, and it was certainly the desire, as Brother Jim has indicated, that the Babylonians were going to overthrow the Assyrians, and Brother Jim pointed out to that prophecy in Daniel chapter 7 about the plucking off of the wings and the man's heart being given to this Chaldean dynasty sort of thing and the emergence of Babylon. Just a couple of thoughts leading on from that. In Isaiah chapter 14, we read, "Rejoice not, thou whole Palestina, because the rod of him that smote thee is broken, for out of the serpent's root shall come forth a cockatrice, and his fruit shall be a fiery flying serpent." Now it appears that at some point in history, and I'm not quite sure of the dates, but that Tiglath-Pileser, one of the kings of Assyria, did destroy the Palestinian coast and maybe annihilated the Philistines and actually reduced their sort of small kingdom to nothing. And when the overthrow of the Assyrian came, it would have been a great time of rejoicing to those who'd suffered under their brutality. But basically the area is told, don't rejoice, because out of the serpent's rod will come forth a cockatrice, and the fruit shall be a fiery flying serpent. And I think that's an indication that out of the destruction of Assyria came forth the power of Babylon, because when Assyria had gone off the scene and created a vacuum, it was soon taken up by the power of Babylon, who became that great and mighty head of gold which the King Nebuchadnezzar dreamed about. Thou art the head of gold. And Brother Thomas, I think it's in Eureka, it indicates that the whole world has found out that this is certainly a fiery serpent. This is the fruit that came from the emergence of Babylon. And because to continue the details of Daniel chapter 4, we know that the great Babylonian tree was cut down in the destruction of Babylon when her turn came for her to be overthrown, but nevertheless the stump remained bound with iron and brass, so that the influence of the Babylonians, it might have been great to see the disappearance of Assyria, but the Babylonian influence, her idolatry and her false religion has been maintained bound with the Grecian and Roman elements down to our very day in which we are living, so that the Roman Catholic apostasy, which is symbolized by the Babylonian Empire, is with us even today and has been a curse upon the earth. And we look forward to the time again when that will be rooted out, and the complete and utter destruction of this false religion will at last give way to the plan and purpose of God in the establishment of the kingdom.
Oh, Brother Matthew.
I'd like to thank Brother Ricky for giving us a very good overview of the chapter of Nahum in the short time allotted to him, and for the subsequent comments which have helped broaden all of our understanding of this chapter, these three chapters rather. I thought I'd just elaborate a little on the points already made on the subject of comfort. As Brother Jim said, Nahum's name means comfort, and yet we look through the chapters of Nahum, and most of it is about judgment and dwelling more upon God's severity than his goodness. But one of the verses which I guess goes along with that underlying theme of comfort is in verse 7 of the first chapter, after he had been talking about the judgments which had even fallen upon Judah. Bashan, Carmel and Lebanon had borne the brunt of the invasion of the Assyrians, but yet God said, Yahweh is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and he knoweth them that trust in him. And there's always the political wrangling, there's various events in the vicissitudes of the human ages and dispensations which sometimes can cause alarm or fear. But if we understand God's purpose, and if we understand the eventual goal of Yahweh's name at the last being manifested on this earth and his glory filling the earth as the waters cover the sea, then we have no reason to fear. Perfect love casteth out fear, and therefore these judgments of God do not pertain to those who faithfully serve him. And in our private affairs, likewise, we might at some times feel as though things might not go perhaps the way we might like them to in various different ways. But in the words of Paul, we know that all things work together for good to them who are the called according to his purpose. So that's one of those little words of comfort, those little gems in the book of Nahum, that Yahweh is good and a stronghold in the day of trouble. And we just need to realize that trusting in the arm of the flesh will serve us nothing. It's like trusting in the broken reed of Egypt. But if we trust in Yahweh, then he will effect our salvation.
Thanks to all the brethren who had comments. And thanks to Brother Ricky Hurst for the opening remarks.